This week on Lunchbox Envy, in the Navy, they call it Neptune's dandruff.
NASA gives it to their astronauts in liquid form.
And it's the only thing that whales and dolphins are capable of tasting.
It's salt! And welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Rosie, a chef and food writer, and I'm here with my QI elves, Alex and Manu.
Hello.
Hello, Rosie.
Hey, Rosie.
So nearly said Jack.
Are we ready for salt?
I've been ready my whole life for this because it is literally the backbone of cooking.
As Jack said on a previous episode, it stands apart from everything else in cooking because it's a core chemical. Mm. It does three things, really, I think. So, firstly, obviously, we use it to make food taste nice. So it is an ingredient in that sense. But on a really basic level, all animals, including humans, need it to stay alive. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't just like it. We need a certain amount. Mm. And then it's also had this massive, massive impact culturally on how we store food, preserve food, and entire civilizations and cities have been built on the ability to do that. So it's like, it's unbelievable. And doing this research, I realized there's no such thing as artificial salt. Mm-mm. There are lots of different types, but all the salt we have comes from the earth.
Well, it all comes from the sea.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah,
it's close. Got that wrong straight out of the gate.
Yeah, and we should mention that the main one that we're all familiar with, table salt, is sodium chloride. Mm-hmm. So that's the one that we have in front of us. Mark Kalansky, who wrote Salt, A History, fabulous work. He has a really nice way of describing like table salt. So he says, when sodium, an unstable metal that can suddenly burst into flame, reacts with a deadly poisonous gas known as chlorine, that makes sodium chloride. And it's the only family of rocks. Basically, it's the only rock that we eat.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which is well, so the cool. only rock we're supposed to eat.
Yeah. Yes.
The World Health Organization is trying to reduce the global salt intake by 30%.
What?
Like, we all, as a planet, need to reduce it by 30%. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I've made a pact with myself that it's like a life worth living is a life well seasoned. So I will be eating my salt and figuring it out.
That is a quote. I love that quote.
I was going to say, you got to get that tattooed somewhere. It's beautiful.
Yeah, salt's really woven tight into our society as well. So there are so many places where there was salt as a resource, and that's why there's a city there. Mm. So Salzburg in Austria literally means salt castle because the city got so rich from the nearby salt mines. But there are some amazing, incredibly salty places on Earth.
The saltiest
places on Earth. There's a documentary series I want to present. What do you reckon the saltiest body of water is?
Well, it's the Dead Sea, right?
So no.
What?
QI Paxson.
Classic.
Yeah. There's actually a small lake in Antarctica called Don Juan Pond, which
Wait, how was I supposed to fucking know that?
Which is 40% salt. That's so salty. So you could, even at minus 50 degrees Celsius, it still stays liquid because the freezing point is so low. And the only thing that can live in it are like extremophile microbes, basically.
Yeah.
There are some amazing salt flats in Bolivia.
Mm. Been there.
You have. What are they called? The
Salar de Uyuni. The classic thing that you do when you go there is you take pictures of your friends because it's so flat. There's virtually no perspective. Is that what I'm looking for? You do a picture where you've got your friend standing maybe like 10 or 15 meters away, and then you put your hand over the top of them, and it looks like you're picking up a tiny friend. But it is incredibly beautiful and cool.
Mm. Is it man-made?
No, it's natural.
Whoa.
And apparently, because it gets very shiny when it's wet, it's basically a huge mirror. And so it's very useful for calibrating satellites in space.
Ah, cool. Mm.
Salt mines, we should talk about salt mines as well.
Oh, that's something I've done.
You went to the salt mines?
Went to the one in Kraków in Poland.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it was so beautiful. Like, they got a church in there. Like,
made of salt?
It's all made of salt.
This is the 13th century one. Mm-hmm.
Veliska.
Veliska, yeah. But yeah, apparently this is an enormous salt mine, right? Mm-hmm. And the miners, they dug out huge amounts to mine salt. But then they sculpted incredible rooms and statues.
Yeah, there's a restaurant and everything. It's so cool.
Wow, you don't even need to see any food there.
No.
It just comes from the ceiling.
Just wipe it against the walls.
To be fair, we were told repeatedly not to lick the walls. And I must have been about 12 or 13. Obviously, I licked the wall. It was very dusty. It wasn't a good idea. But yeah.
It's quite Willy Wonka. There's also a hotel made of salt in Bolivia where they've made bricks out of salt and they've built.
Yeah, we stayed there.
Oh, did you?
Nice. Yeah, we're on the bloody tour. Whoa. Sorry, I forgot about that.
Do you understand why I consider you like the queen of salt now? Because like,
it was really cold, but very enjoyable. Highly enjoyable.
All the furniture is made out of salt as well.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's the whole thing. Like you sit on blocks of salt. Uh-huh. Everything is salty because the salt is almost blue. Mm. You look like you're almost in an igloo, but
Whoa,
you're not.
That's so cool.
It's salty.
I'd like to know whether they've got, you know, they've got a restaurant room made of salt, and then they've got tables made of salt, and then they've got a salt shaker made of salt, and then in that they've got salt.
Yeah.
But on the mining, archaeological evidence of salt production from over 7,000 years ago, humans have been taking salt and using it as a resource for a really long time, and mainly for preservation, because that is the absolute key to civilization building, is being able to raise an army or build a navy and take food with you so that you can travel. For a long time, it was really the only way to do it.
And that's because it draws moisture out of things which would otherwise feed microbes that decay whatever you're trying to preserve.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons why old salt mines are often converted into deep storage archives, because A, they're often deep down and quite safe and out of the way.
Uh-huh.
So people aren't going to go there. But B, it's a really low humidity environment, so it protects whatever's in there, whether
that's
it's documents
so cool.
or I actually watched a really weird video about the Laura Ashley archive, which is like in a sort of underground bunker.
Why does that need to be that?
Yeah, honestly, the funniest video I've ever seen, because they've got this huge underground storage facility with a lot of very serious archivists talking about preserving the archive, and I'm like, yeah, but it's Laura Ashley.
Let's find out what's in our first lunchbox, and today it's sweet manu.
Sweet manu.
Distinctly salty.
Today, salty manu. All right. I went to the pet shop today.
Okay, that's not a good salt.
And I bought the Himalayan salt lick.
Ooh.
Ooh.
For animals.
Yes, for animals.
Okay.
Do you want to lick a thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm an animal.
I guess so.
I mean, we are also animals, so we could give it a lick.
I didn't know this was a thing.
Oh, yes, it is.
It is literally a fist-sized block of
heavy. Do you guys
Himalayan
want it?
Salt rock. Yeah. It is literally a rock. And this is what, for animals to lick?
Mm-hmm. Like we said, all animals need salt to survive. Mm-hmm. It's really important with regulating the amount of fluids in your body. Also, our nervous system to send messages to our muscles. Basically, we cannot move, we cannot think or do anything important without salt. Carnivores actually get salt from their diet naturally, because meat and blood has an amount of salt in it. Herbivores or vegetarians, it is a lot harder to get natural salts if you're not eating meat.
So a salt lick is something to put in your fields to supplement.
So this is a tiny one, which you could put in your garden for your rabbit and or guinea pig.
We're going to demonstrate. Come on, hang it up, money.
Surprisingly salty. Oh, wow. I'm going to give you the other side.
It is very salty.
What were you expecting?
I don't know. I didn't really prepare myself.
Yeah, good. You guys have had your time with it.
It's not a nice salty.
No, this is very salty.
It does taste like the sea.
I was always told that, like, if you have a dog or a cat as a pet, if they are licking you in a sort of more excessive way, like coming up to you and giving you a really good lick on
the
hand,
licking your sweat off.
It's because they want your salt. They're going, it's like they know that you can have some salt on the surface of your skin. So they're like, okay, cool, I'll just grab some from here.
Yeah, no, that is
clever.
That is exactly right. Like I said, you can put this out in your garden for your rabbits, your guinea pigs. You can get enormous ones for cattle and horses.
Yeah.
So they'll be like the size of a rugby ball, and you hang those on a fence and the cows go absolutely crazy.
There's a huge one in the steam room in my gym.
Why?
Well, I don't know. Now I'm wondering if I should be licking it.
I don't really think you should. Can I be honest with you?
But yeah, to be fair, like the more you sweat, the more salt you need. But it's really cool because like, it's not just big cows and big cattle that need to supplement their salt. So elephants as well, who are herbivores, they go mad trying to find salt. So there's a really beautiful cave in Kenya called the Katoom Cave, which is about 200 meters into the side of Mount Elgon. And it's been carved out by elephants digging for salt and lots of other kind of animals as well. But
and have they made beautiful chapels and statues as well?
You know what? They've left some really beautiful tusk marks in the side of the wall. It's really cool.
Wow.
I'd like to go stay in the Elephant Hotel.
Yeah, I know. Elephant Salt Hotel. That sounds great. Also a great band name.
Yeah.
I would listen to that. Porcupines in particular, there's a lot of stuff written on how obsessed they are with toilets. So,
as in our toilets?
Yeah, yeah. So especially in if you're going camping, they'll have outhouse toilets, just like kind of old school.
Mm.
And often they'll be kind of demolished by porcupines who are crunching for salt in the wood because our urine is full of salt as well.
Right.
Mm. So we pee out about like 90% of the dietary salt that we eat. So our pee is quite salty. But another animal that is famous for going after human pea salt is the mountain goat.
Yes.
Oh yeah, they love a human pea. They can lick the same urine-soaked patch left by a hiker for up to 10 days. That's how long the salt will be viable in that area for. And just on, you were talking about animals licking you for the salt. There's a really famous like medieval torture method, which is called like goat licking.
Oh my God.
Which is when they'd put your feet in a load of salty water and then lock you up and bring in the goat, which would like lick the flesh off your foot.
Oh, because they have really rough tongues.
Yeah, they
have my gosh, that's super horrible.
Rough tongues. But yeah, so they love a bit of pee. They love a human foot.
Bring back the salt goat torture, I say, for the naysayers.
what would you have that be a punishment for?
Not seasoning your food well enough.
Oh, fair.
Should we talk about humans eating salt? Because I feel like that's the point of this podcast. I had no idea that the salt that we use in our food has something else in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is iodine.
Ooh.
Mm.
So similarly to how fluoride is put in the drinking water by the government in order to improve our dental health, iodine is put into our salt. Basically, since the 1920s, up until then, there was a lot of widespread illnesses to do with iodine deficiency, specifically goiters.
Goiters is when you get a giant lump on your neck.
Thyroid, yeah.
Yeah.
And then in the 20s, Switzerland started adding iodine to the salt. And now more than 120 countries do it. And 80% of the global population get a lot of their iodine through salt.
Ah. And was there a big reduction in goiters?
Yes.
Another good reason to eat loads of salt.
It is considered one of the simplest and cheapest and most effective human health interventions in history.
Really? So
yeah,
cool.
And I had no idea.
Yeah.
But the UK largely doesn't participate in this. And instead, they try to give it to us via their dairy by feeding cows iodine-fortified feed. And I don't think it's quite as effective. So we have a few more problems.
What if you're vegan?
Well, exactly. It just doesn't reach everyone as much, as whereas salt really goes into all foods at some point, whether you buy it in the supermarket or at home.
Mm-hmm. Do we know why we decided not to do what everyone else was doing and having great success with?
I don't know. It's really unlike us, isn't it? Tap out of like our system that works totally fine. Should we talk about some of the different types of salts that you can get in the supermarket?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, from a scientific perspective.
Yeah.
In chemistry, salt is a really broad thing. So any like compound that is formed from an acid-base reaction is called a salt. But the salt that we eat is called sodium chloride.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
There are a few different types. So the stuff that you get from the mines, like is what I think is called rock salt.
Mm-hmm.
It comes in rocks, you grind it down.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes very kind of fine and evenly grained. And that's what you get in your average kind of bag of salt in the supermarket. Then the other one I know of is sea salt, which is made by taking seawater and evaporating the water out in ponds, and it leaves salt in these much more kind of like natural crystal shapes.
Yeah.
But it also leaves little tiny bits of marine compounds and shit from your sea, which gives it a little bit of extra, taste, a little bit of extra tang to it.
Yeah. If you want a slightly gentler, softer seasoning, salt flavor, sea salt is really good because it's much easier to dissolve because of its flaky crystalline structure. And
it's used to being in water.
Table salt, i.e. from rock salt, is what you would use for a sort of a harsher, stronger, robust salting. Mm-hmm.
to like baking when you need that taste.
A little bit of baking, and like just general sort of, you know, on your chips, for example. Mm-hmm. Like you can go hard on the chips there. They'll take it.
I mean, I'm just going to double down. All salt is sea salt. Like, like even the stuff in the mines.
To be clear.
That is really old, evaporated sea salt that's got stuck in the ground. So it is still from the sea, but it's just we're mining it now.
So I guess the distinction is sea salt that's marketed as sea salt now is fresh.
Yeah, fresh from the sea.
Yeah.
But even there are distinctions between types of sea salt, which is super cool. So say when you've evaporated it in the salt pans, there's a specific kind of salt that forms on the surface layer of the seawater, which is the flaky salt or fleur de sel, chef salt. Molten salt is another example. So it's basically like under specific temperature and wind conditions, the salt evaporates in a specific way that creates those amazing kind of pyramid structures, but they form upside down on the surface of the water. So which is how they're kind of like buoyant and staying on the top. And then you gently skim those off. And then the other like less refined, less flaky salt from the sea kind of sinks to the bottom of the pan. So you get like big chunky sea salt when it's evaporated, but also there's beautiful flaky ones on the top, which is normally way more expensive. Salt comes in an incredible variety of price ranges as well.
Totally.
It's mad. So say like Himalayan salt, Himalayan pink salt.
And that's from the Himalayan mountains.
Yes, exactly. So there's a really famous salt mine in Pakistan called Kerawa, which is where most of the Himalayan pink salt comes from. And it's made pink primarily by iron oxide in the rock. So it's an impurity that gives it its beautiful color. It's also the same kind of chemical that makes rust yellow. So it's like
Rusty salt.
Yeah, it's like a sexy, expensive rust salt. And the way that they mine it is really specific because it's all mostly chipped off by hand. So this, I'm holding up the salt lick. This would have been chipped away by hand. If anyone fancies another go.
Hand-picked.
There's also Icelandic sea salt.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's basically no sun or heat in Iceland, the way they evaporate their seawater is by using...
Oh, let me guess, volcano?
Yeah, kind of. No, exactly. They use geothermal energy.
It's all they got. They just got volcanoes. It's then as dark all the time. And then like periodically the volcanoes melt all the roads.
Iceland tourism, if you're listening.
I'd love to go.
I think it's a cool country. I think you're being a bit harsh.
I think it's amazing. Yeah.
So they use the geothermal springs and they pump that underneath the salt pans. And it's all like artisanal. It's beautiful stuff. Crazy expensive, but not as expensive as my favorite salt, bamboo salt. Have you guys heard of bamboo salt?
No.
Made by pandas?
No, I wish.
Does it form inside bamboos?
I mean, it's cooked in bamboo.
Oh.
So it's the salt they make in Korea where they get sea salt, good quality, but bog standard sea salt. And then they cook it in hollowed out bamboo stalks, which are plugged at either end with a special kind of clay.
So like a rain stick?
Yeah, but like a really densely packed salty rain stick, which doesn't make any noise. And then they put that in the kiln, they superheat it, they take it out and it's formed like a solid salty
tube.
Exactly.
And then you twist one end of it and the salt comes out of the end.
That's a good idea. But they do that 8 times with the same salt pillar. So they'll cook it, break it down, cook it, break it down. And then the 9th time, they cook the shit out of it until everything is molten. So like...
Even the salt is molten.
The salt is molten lava salt.
Molten salt. Think about that, Molten, as a new brand.
And then that is cooled down, and when they break it apart, it looks like geodes. It's black, it's beautiful.
Oh, wow.
And it costs a bomb. So this kind of table salt, the one we have in front of us, normally costs about like $1 to $1.50 per kg. This costs £250 per kg. And then I couldn't find any. I really wanted to get some.
We don't have the budget for that money.
Fine.
What's the point, though? Does it really have that much of a difference on the effect of your food?
Well, because it's been like soaking up and cooked with the bamboo and the clay so much, I think it will have an impact to the taste because all of those minerals, say like with the Himalayan salt, what you're tasting is like the stuff in the salt that is not the salt. So it will have picked up some of that flavor. There's another example of this, way more affordable, which is Himalayan black salt. And that has a very specific flavor. Would you like to try?
Yes, you've got some.
Yeah.
More salt.
We need more salt.
Okay. While you're getting it, can we just talk about kosher salt for a sec?
Yes.
Because kosher salt is the sort of like the salt of choice of all American food writers, chefs, recipe creators. And they're always like, and you got to get your kosher salt. And I was always like, why? Like, what's the big difference?
So I was just assumed it was kosher in a religious way. I was blessed in some way.
Yeah, yeah.
But apparently it's not. Apparently it's good for making meats kosher.
Yeah.
And it's because of the makeup of it. It's very, very easy to sprinkle. And it has really, really coarse grains, which sticks to food. And it's very, very good for drawing out the moisture and drawing out the blood, and that's part of how you make the meat kosher.
And I guess maybe it has become culturally a preference in America because there's more Jewish people there using it. It's just more available, whereas like in this country we don't really see it very much.
So you have some black Himalayan salt.
I do. So this is Himalayan black salt, or Kala Namak, which is usually made in India.
It's beautiful.
It is really beautiful. So this one is called Indian black salt.
She's done it.
I don't need no man. It
For
is.
For context, she was opening the jar.
Give that a smell.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a nice full circle because in one of the first episodes, you fed us all raw pepper and now we're getting raw salt. Okay.
Guys, it smells like boiled egg.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. Okay, right. There's salt, the first taste of salt, and then very much egg. Like, it tastes so much like egg.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
So this is a salt that's been prepped with a lot of sodium sulfate in it as well. So another kind of salt.
Yeah.
It's in sulfur.
Alex is fighting for his life after trying to eat a piece of eggy black salt.
This has not been a great episode for trying foods.
Not so yet.
We haven't got very far. We are going to move on now to our second lunchbox, and that is mine today.
Thank God. She'll have brought something edible, Manu.
I hope I've brought something edible. So, have you ever had anything baked in a salt crust before?
I don't think I have. Oh, wow. They look like pastries.
It's beautiful.
I have baked 3 potatoes in a salt dough or a salt crust.
So what we've got in front of us here, 3 regular looking potatoes.
Yes.
And then sort of some crazy salty, crusty, melty mess next to it. And some butter.
And some butter. So these have been baked regularly. They're just little new potatoes. And these have been baked in a salt crust.
Oh, okay.
So there are specific reasons why you would make a salt crust and bake something in it. It is an incredibly gentle and consistent way of cooking because the salt crust creates insulation against intense heat and draws out surface moisture, but then locks it in because it forms this crust.
Mm.
So basically you end up with this incredibly efficient steam inside that tenderizes and cooks your food really, really, really well.
It's a bit like baking a potato and wrapping it in tinfoil, except you're wrapping it in salt, so you're also getting all of those benefits from salt.
The other thing is that you are, of course, seasoning your food, and it's become, you know, internally seasoned very well. But most typically you'd see fish or things that are like really delicate cooked like this, because it is a really, really nice way of cooking delicate things. You can control it. It's gentle.
It's so natural as well.
It's very natural.
Everything is like from the earth.
Yeah.
How do you actually make a crust?
So yeah, there are different types of salt crusts that you can make. This one I made with rock salt, a tiny bit of fine salt. I kind of just eyeballed it, to be honest, guys, and a couple of egg whites. That's why it's gone this dark color, because the presence of the egg basically is what caramelizes in the baking. You can just make a salt crust with literally rock salt and water, and that will come out still pretty pure white at the end of cooking. But egg whites are more useful for binding. So if you have to shape your dough around something that's a little bit more fiddly, an egg white crust is quite good. And
I'm so disappointed it turns out this has egg in it as well. There's more egg salt.
I know.
I just said I didn't like eggy salt.
But you won't taste that. So I decided to do potatoes and not fish, because I was like, I'd love to try a salt-baked potato next to a basic potato and see how good it is. So Alex, would you like to do the honors of cracking into the salt crust?
Probably
this bit here. So importantly, don't eat the dough. You don't want to eat that.
It's too salty.
Oh yeah, no, it's not great. It's not a great smell.
So yeah, so definitely just kind of like brush off as much salt as possible. But I think what I'd love you to sort of really observe is the flavor of the potato itself. Does it taste more potato-y? Because it is almost steamed in its own juices. Is that actually intensifying the potato flavor as much as the salt part of it?
Okay, ready? Oh, wow. Well, it is very salty.
Oh, they are very tender.
Aren't they so tender?
Gosh, yeah, the really like intense taste. A lot of salt, a lot of potato. The texture is really nice. Wow. And then also just the satisfaction of breaking through this quite alien structure to get to your food is quite fun.
There's no other thing other than the salt contributing to the cooking of this.
The regular potato is so plain in comparison.
Right?
Well, great. Thanks, Rosie. You've ruined potatoes for me now. Now I can only cook them with this insane amount of salt.
It's not just good for potatoes. Like, it is great for fish. Chicken is actually amazing.
Oh, that sounds really good.
The earliest recipe that was ever found for a sort of salt baked thing written down was actually in the 4th century BCE in Archistratus's Life of Luxury. He was a Greek philosopher.
I love all these ancient recipes we found in the last few years. Like, there's something so exciting about, like, olives that a philosopher ate from ancient Greece.
Yeah.
This is exactly how they cook the fish.
Yeah, and it is still a really popular method of cooking fish across the Mediterranean and West Asia as well. And then also in China and Southeast Asia, you'll see a lot of salt baking of meats, particularly chicken. It's really good for something like, I would say, a pusa, because they're so small and they can get really dry really quickly. If you could salt bake it, the thing that you lose with salt baking is you lose any caramelization on the outside. Yeah. So you don't get a Maillard reaction because there's too much water, there's no fat. So if you want that, you can do a sort of either a pre or post sear, but obviously you are going to then affect the moisture content of the thing you've cooked.
Yeah, it's a trade-off. It's just counterintuitive though, because you'd think that coating something in salt and then heating it up would make it the driest, most desiccated thing ever. And
but it doesn't.
It's made this is amazing, like, contained thing, which actually has made the potatoes really thick and juicy.
Yeah. I just think it's also, like you said, like drama, like pure vibes.
Oh.
A big pile of salt put in front of you.
Well, speaking of drama and vibes, are the risks of making you really angry? What are your thoughts on Salt Bae?
Salt Bae.
And Salt Bae, in context, is basically this random guy.
It's a way to show his muscles off.
There was a chef in America? An American chef?
No, he was Turkish.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. A Turkish chef who came up with just this like camp way of seasoning his food front of his guests. By if you're doing like the shadow puppet of an ostrich.
Yeah.
And then you'll pinch your salt. So you pinch your salt and you run it down your forearm onto your food, which is gross.
I think it was just like a viral, like he'd done a lot of good viral marketing on his restaurant in Turkey, which is like a state restaurant. He would come out with his massive knife and slice off his T-bones and then cut them up, and then he'd season them a la Salt Bae.
Yeah.
And in a way, like, fair play to him.
People would pay hundreds of dollars.
Yeah, they still do. Yeah, he has a restaurant in Dubai where everything is wrapped in gold leaf and stuff.
Doesn't he have one in London as well?
Does. Mayfair. Yeah,
it's
like
got the famous gold leaf steak.
Wow. Yeah,
it's extortionate.
Yeah, I don't think he wants to be known only as Salt Bae. He thinks he's much more serious guy than that. It was a nickname because he was like this kind of handsome guy. He had his like small little
tiny
weird
glasses.
Like Nicholas.
Yeah. I do have a question about when bakers are chucking their flour to like evenly spread it. Can you have tekkers with salt spreading? Because Salt Bae's done the thing.
I think you can. Oh, I think you definitely want to season from a height. I remember being taught that actually at culinary school. Well, I wanted to talk a lot today about how to season your food.
Okay.
So, Manuel, I think you're right. There is, it's better to season from a height because then if you, for example, don't mix well enough, you will have got a better surface area of seasoning anyway. But I think something that is really hard to teach, and it's perpetually a problem of mine when I'm writing recipes, truthfully, because, there's so much stigma around what salt does to your body and how healthy it is. But I think what people forget is that actually when you eat out in restaurants, there is a lot more salt than you think there is. You are obviously not in control of how much is added. And we season as chefs liberally and we season often. When you season like a chef, you season in layers. So you start your dish, let's say it's a tomato sauce for a pasta. you've added your oil, and then you've added some chopped onions. This is going to be a two-ingredient pasta sauce. It's just tomatoes and onions. You season your onions as soon as they go in the pan. I do anyway. One, I need to season because I need to season the first layer of my dish. Mm-hmm. Two, it's actually useful to season your onions because it draws out moisture, stops them from burning in the pan if you've got the heat on a little bit too high. So onions have gone in, they've cooked down. Next thing you add is your tin of tomatoes or whatever it is, fresh tomatoes. Those go in, you immediately season again.
Mm.
And you do taste, you're tasting the whole time. Every time you add a bit more salt, it draws out moisture and flavor of that ingredient. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're now going to simmer and cook. They're going to reduce down. And that will actually change the properties of the sauce. And it will intensify the salt flavor because there's less water. That means the salt will be more concentrated. But then you're going to add some pasta to it, which dilutes it again. Mm-hmm. So you need to think, okay, I have to season one more time. You never assume that it's ready until you've tasted it and checked the seasoning.
Mm.
If you're thinking, oh, it's tasting a bit weak, it's tasting a bit insipid, I wish I could, you know, taste a bit more tomato or whatever, then you might need to add a bit more salt. There are other things you might need to add too, but it's a good place to start is adding your salt. There is actually an amazing quote, which I'm going to read to you by the amazing food writer Tamar Adler. All ingredients need salt. The noodle or tender spring pea would be narcissistic to imagine it already contained within its cell walls all the perfection it would ever need. We seem, too, to fear that we are failures at being tender and springy if we need to be seasoned. It's not so. It doesn't reflect badly on pea or person that either needs help to be its most itself. Oh. It's such a sweet quote.
That's such a lovely quote.
And that's basically what chefs know to do. Every ingredient needs a little bit of help and a little bit of salt.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that does frustrate me. As someone who, when I cook, I want to follow the recipe. Mm. I want clear instructions and seasoned to taste. Pisses me off because I'm like, actually, I want to know that I'm putting in half a tablespoon of marjoram, this specific amount of salt. How do you season to taste if you're not a pro?
Well, it's very difficult. It is subjective. Yeah. Like, there are some people who eat my food and think, fucking hell, Rosie, over season much, you know? Or they think, my God, that's the best thing I've ever tried. What have you put in it? And I'm like, salt. not that many.
That's interesting that it's almost like part of the mechanics of cooking rather than part of the recipe.
Yeah.
Is that you should sort of be thinking every time you do a step.
There was one more thing I did want to talk about, which is salt in baking. Because I think it's often doesn't feel very intuitive to add salt to sweet things.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a few reasons why you should never, ever leave it out. And actually, if it's not in the recipe, it's maybe good to add it in.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a cake recipe, for example, that you really won't need more than half a teaspoon to a teaspoon of salt.
Mm.
But it's important, and I'll tell you why. It's obviously a flavor enhancer. It brings out the best of other flavors. It also suppresses any bitterness. Sometimes you can get bitterness when you add baking powder or bicarb. Those things are inherently bitter. It's just good for the overall flavor profile. In yeast recipes, salt regulates the yeast's fermentation rate. That means that you'll get a better fermentation because it's more controlled. It's a little bit more even. So if you're making a dough or you're making, you know, whatever it is, a little bit of salt in the dough is important. Salt is also good at strengthening gluten. So again, for a dough, you need a bit of salt to help that gluten structure form, make it become bigger, airier, stretchier, whatever it is you're looking for in that dough. The other thing is that it actually is really good for the texture. So it can basically create a better crumb structure because it's sort of like drawing out that moisture, creating air pockets of moisture in the dough.
Oh, that's interesting. I never considered that salt affects texture.
Yeah. And it also plays a role in the browning because, again, that moisture is there to react with the sugars and the other things. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's basically just like a non-negotiation. Don't leave your salt out of your baking. It's really important.
What about unsalted butter in baking? Because that, I've always been like, why is that a thing? Salt's amazing. Surely I just use salted
butter. But in most recipes, they'll say put unsalted butter in and then they'll tell you to add salt.
Yeah.
It's so stupid. It's like, can't I just use salted butter?
Yeah.
Well, it's not quite the same thing.
Actually, can't just buy a whole done cake actually at that point.
Yeah. It's not quite the same thing because the salt, when it's in the butter, is like dissolved and it's different in its properties, right, to when you add physical salt. Mm-hmm. So obviously for flavor, yes, it would make a difference to use salted butter. And I often do on top of salt, for example, in brownies, things where it's really, really rich, like a flapjack, where I want like a little bit of salt to kind of kick through.
Mm-hmm.
I'll double up and I'll use salted butter and I'll use salt in the recipe.
Yeah.
In a more delicate recipe, you just have more control if you use unsalted butter. And I think there is like different schools of thought on this, but you're in control of the overall seasoning of whatever it is you're making. And that's why in restaurants as well, we actually use unsalted butter when we cook rather than salted butter, because again, we'd rather add the salt ourselves.
Yeah, so precise.
Because the golden rule of cooking, which I say all the time, and I'm sure I've said it before, is
don't let Alex cook.
Don't let Alex cook. But it's also, you can always add, but you can't take away. So if you add your salted butter and you add a big pinch of salt because you're layering your seasoning, and then suddenly you're like, shit, it's already too salty, there's not much you can do. In fact, that's a lie. There are a couple of things you can do.
You can add more of everything else, but then you've just got so much food.
So there are a couple of ways where if you have over-seasoned something, you can try and bring it back. The best thing that will help your dishes if you've really over-seasoned it is any kind of starch. Starch absorbs...
Of course, yeah. Suck it up, yeah.
A flour slurry of some kind, like...
Yum.
Yeah, you're not selling it.
You can't just add a spoonful of flour to a liquid because it won't dissolve and it'll be lumpy. So you need to pre-dissolve your flour and then add it in. Okay. But flour is probably the most effective thing. A little drop of milk as well, like fat, is really good. And sometimes actually vinegar. Mm. Vinegar is a better thing to add because it creates acidity, which can relieve you of some of that overarching, like, harsh saltiness. And it's not always suitable for what you're doing. That's the problem. So, I take this with a pinch of salt, as they say. Like,
no, don't. You already added too much.
And now for our third and final lunchbox, we are coming to you, Alex. What have you got for us today?
This week, I have brought a different type of salt from sodium chloride.
Ooh.
I brought this bag of potassium nitrate, also known as saltpeter.
Ooh. Saltpeter!
Do you know it? So you're familiar?
Yes, I do. I've always wanted to see what it looked like. It's not that exciting.
It looks exactly like regular salt. Yeah, comes in a sort of big commercial bag. You tend to really only buy it commercially or industrially. So yeah, the reason I brought this was because I wanted to show that there are lots of other different types of salt that we use besides sprinkling sodium chloride in our food. Mm-hmm. And it's also such a key part of our culture, our economy, and also our history, how we've built societies and cities. Like it's right since the beginning, from thousands and thousands of years. It is a naturally occurring mineral. It's used in food, it's used in agriculture, and it's also used in warfare.
I knew that it was used in food. And I knew that, like, there was some reasons why we couldn't always get hold of it when we were doing shoots and stuff, because it's dangerous, right?
In certain quantities, and if you do certain things with it, yes.
Right.
Is it salty? I'm assuming it's salty.
Yeah, it is salty.
Okay,
yeah.
So I got it.
Yeah.
Saltpeter sounds like something like Rumpelstiltskin-y, like, yes. Saltpeter. Like, it's like a scary, withered old salty man that's going to come and get you.
You can keep the rights to that children's book, I think.
Okay, thank you.
So, saltpeter has been used for a lot of things. It's used as a fertilizer because it's got lots of nitrogen and potassium in it, which are very, very good for plant growth. Mm-hmm. It was also historically used in brining for preserving food. Okay. So that's when you put salt in a water solution to tenderize the meat, to flavor the meat, to kill off the bacteria, to keep the meat fresh. And saltpeter is very good for that because it keeps the color of the meat as well as preserving it. It was also used on an alchemy in history as well. They loved experimenting with it because it's combustible.
Right. Oh, that's why.
And it is one of the three ingredients of gunpowder.
Oh.
Yeah, along with charcoal and sulfur.
Can we?
No, absolutely not.
Fine.
I just wanted to bring it to show how versatile salt is and how many things we use it for. Not just eating, not just preserving, but for killing each other. There is one myth, which I think is not true, that saltpeter was secretly added to soldiers' food in order to suppress their libido so that they would concentrate on being soldiers.
Wait.
But it's not true.
So people think that this is the opposite of an aphrodisiac.
Yes. For the first time ever. This is a non-aphrodisiac.
I just can't think of a word that's like a...
Turn off?
Yeah, there we go. I was going to say the boner killer.
Yeah, I'm like, boner
killer. That's not the word.
Of the 300 million tons of salt produced annually, only about 15 to 20% we use on food.
Oh.
It's used a lot in the manufacturing industries for making paper and glass and plastic and food and soaps and all these other things. It's absolutely essential. Mm-hmm. We use it in textiles. We use it in dyes. In the winter, obviously, we put it on our roads to stop ice from forming on the roads.
You know, all of those animals that love licking salt. They love licking salty roads as well.
Oh, that's why
there's so many collisions in winter.
With animals.
Yeah, because they're all on the salty paths.
Oh my God. Wow.
And they get hit by a car.
There has to be a better way.
Well, they are also trying to phase out using salt and using other types of gritty materials because it's really bad for the environment when you put loads of salts on the roads and then it washes away and goes into the
ecosystem.
In the rivers and ecosystem. Sure. Exactly. So that's not ideal. They also use it in skiing for the same reason. It melts the snow and allows it to refreeze at a lower temperature. So it makes firmer snow, which is kind of interesting.
Cool.
Yeah, you've heard of the phrase salting the earth.
Mm.
So that is supposedly a reference to ancient civilizations that were warring. And most famously, the Romans, when they defeated Carthage.
Mm.
The legend is that they sprinkled salt over the fields around Carthage in order to make the fields useless for growing, basically.
Right.
To make it a really hostile environment for plants to grow. The idea being that then once they defeated Carthage then couldn't rise again. The city was kind of done forever. But the salting the earth almost certainly didn't happen because... A, salt is very valuable.
Yes.
And it would have taken so much salt to make the fields ungrowable.
Yeah.
And B, actually, in small quantities, salt actually helps.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a fertilizer.
It's a fertilizer, exactly. Yeah. So it's really unlikely that it happened, but it's still a saying nonetheless. Yeah.
So I mentioned Salt, A History by Karl Kalansky earlier. Such, I think, potentially one of the best introductions to a book I've ever read. He opens with the idea of salt being like so integral to human history, like having such a big, strong, like cultural significance. But one of the best things he looks at is a essay that was written by Ernest Jones, who is a really good friend of Freud, so a psychologist, a Welsh Jungian psychologist, who is trying to unpick the human obsession with salt. All of these ancient traditions, the Abyssinians, when someone came to your home, you give them a salt block to lick and it's like, welcome, have some salt.
if everyone's licking the same salt block, like, there's got to be some hygiene issues.
I mean, it's also
here.
Antimicrobial.
Salt's a very good antibacterial. Yeah.
Exactly. So
didn't we used to put salt on wounds?
Yeah, no, it was used medicinally as well. Yeah. Loads of really good uses in medicine because it's cleansing. Mm. So when you have a sore throat, you do your salt gargle. It's actually recommended by doctors.
The other thing is cleansing, iodine.
Yeah.
Double cleansing.
Mm. And that's also why there's such a big, strong tradition of salt keeping away and warding off evil spirits.
The like throwing it over your shoulder kind of thing.
Did that until about literally this time last year.
Really?
If I spilled any salt,
then
the devil is watching me.
Yeah.
I would throw 3 pinches of salt over each shoulder into the devil's eye.
Yeah, no, that's...
And that is why her food is so over-seasoned. She was always standing
like at everyone. My floor is so crunchy. And Tom was like, where is our salt budget going?
Another famous one in Japan, sumo wrestlers purify the sumo ring with salt.
Yeah.
And if a woman goes in the ring, oh, heaven forbid, that is now a dirty place.
Wow.
You've got to throw salt all over it again. In fact, there was a case where someone was injured and these 2 female doctors came into the ring. They were like, stop throwing salt all over the place.
Really?
Incredible.
In kitchens, if we ever had a big spill of oil, which did happen more often than you might think, like, you know, 2-liter pots of pomace oil just going on the floor, the best way to clean it up was to absolutely layer it in salt, like fine salt, because the salt soaks up all the oil and becomes more of like a, you'd be able to get that oil as a solid almost, like, rather than having to deal with dabbing and greasy oil everywhere.
It's not hot. It's really funny you mentioned the kind of salt as a anti-aphrodisiac, because another thing that the psychologist was really hot on was its links with fertility. So lots of people throughout history have linked kind of saltiness and sexiness. So there was this idea that because ships carrying salt tended to have so many mice on them, people thought that mice could reproduce asexually just because they were in salt, which is obviously not the case. And then the Romans called a man in love salax, which meant to be in a salted state or to be salty. And that's where we get the word salacious.
Ah,
no.
I mean, I get the salt without going into too much detail, there is saltiness involved in men and sex.
That's exactly what Ernest Jones was saying.
But also, isn't the word salary from salt?
It is, but again, that's another kind of a myth, that the idea that Roman soldiers were paid in salt, and that's why it's called a salary. Mm-hmm. It's, again, unlikely, because it's actually not very practical.
Yeah.
Then, and also, they had a really functional coin system, famously. Mm-hmm. So, like, there's no reason to be paid in a raw material.
They're but great money.
I think there's the idea that because salt was such an integral part of life, you needed it, and it was kind of like buying toilet paper.
Yeah.
Potentially, there was, like, a separate allowance that they were given to buy salt to take with them when they were traveling as part of the army. Potentially, that's where salary came from, which would make a lot of sense. You're given there's travel expenses, really, and that's like a bag of salt.
Need my salt money.
Salt was a really big part of the Roman Empire, in fact. There were these special salt roads. Like, there was one literally called the Via Salaria, which led to Rome, and it supplied the whole empire with salt. Because when you've got these huge civilizations, you then have enormous amounts of people, a lot of preservation needed, got to feed a lot of people. You've got a lot of livestock, which need their salt, as you say. And there is not enough salt naturally around. Yeah. You've got to start transporting it from the sea and from these mines. And so there became a whole economy around salt as a valuable resource. And then you started getting the salt wars, which were entire conflicts based on controlling salt resources around the world. There was also a big culture of salt taxation because people needed salt. You could impose a tax on it and people would have to pay it. Mm. One of the most infamous of these was the French gabelle, which was a really unpopular salt tax. And it was really one of the things which sparked the French Revolution because it was so extortionate. And even it was abolished, and then Napoleon had to reinstate it to fund his wars. And so they had salt taxes until 1946.
Right.
Yeah. Mohandas Gandhi famously did a salt march in 1930, which was to protest against a colonial salt tax, like a British salt tax in India. Yeah. So he walked 240 miles to the sea, where he then defiantly, in front of a crowd, boiled salt from seawater and was like, "Ah, I got my own salt." Mm-hmm. And like, this was like a really big gesture to kind of protest the British salt monopoly and the tax on it. Mm-hmm. And then this was a big act of civil disobedience, and it inspired millions of Indians to kind of break the laws as well and not pay the tax. And, and then again, helps spark the independence movement. So it's kind of a bit like butter in those early episodes.
Yeah.
Like,
don't
fuck with salt.
Definitely. That is it for this week's edition of Lunchbox MB. You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Lunchbox MB Pod.
That's right. You can also get in touch and send us your facts and your recipes and your questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
Rosie, do you have any favourite salty recipes for us today?
Yeah, well, actually, on my newsletter, The Dinner Party, on Substack, I have got a salt bait bass recipe, which if you are dipping your toe into the world of salt crusts and salt baking, then I really recommend you try it, because it is such a delicious way of cooking fish, nice and evenly, and it also looks great, like super dramatic and cool.
Nice.
We will leave you with this from author Margaret Visser. Salt is the policeman of taste. It keeps the various flavors of a dish in order and restrains the stronger from tyrannizing over the weaker.
We'll also leave you with this from chef and food writer Rosie McKean. A life well lived is a life well seasoned.
That's right. All right, we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Alex Bell, Manu Onrio, and me, Rosie McKean. It was mixed by Li Ying Lee and produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.